Environmental Resources Policy and Finance Committee. The date today is Tuesday, January 31st. We have the minutes before us from January 26th. Representative Lewick, would you move those minutes, please?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anybody have any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Oh, I'm sorry. All those in favor of the minutes?
Aye.
Okay, good. Thank you. They're approved.
Happy to help.
Anyway, well, whatever. Today on the agenda, we've got Aaron Vanderland here today to talk about school trust lands. And before we get started, if there's anything that members have for the benefit of the group, I'd entertain that at this time. Otherwise, Director Vanderland, would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent and proceed with your presentation, please? And then if there's anybody else here who wishes to testify that we don't have on the list, make sure that you make your feelings known to the committee administrator. Director.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Aaron Vanderland. I'm the Minnesota School Trust Lands Director. I am the first of my kind in Minnesota. I was appointed by the governor in September of 2015. So I've been on the job for, still can't hear me? Been on the job for a little over a year, almost a year and a half now. Today's update, you know, I'll walk you through a little bit of the background and the history of the school trust lands in Minnesota. Turning the volume. Talk about some of the 2012 legislative changes and my statutory duties. Get into some of the work that my office has been working on over the last year and a half. Do some work on or do some talking about what we're going to be working on into the future. Then at the end, give a brief update on the Boundary Waters Hybrid Land Exchange and Land Sale that we are working on with the Forest Service. Also, at the very end of my presentation, I do have some numbers on the permanent school fund that I've gotten from the SBI annual report. So with that, I know there's some new members, so I got to do a little bit of School Trust 101 for everybody. So really started back in 1787 with the Northwest Ordinance when Minnesota's school trust lands were set aside. Minnesota was the first state to actually get two sections of land. We got Section 16 and 36 in every township. This is basically what a township looks like at 6 square miles. We ended up with Section 16 and 36, more or less in the middle and in the southeast corner of each township. I'll tell you, kind of just in self-deprecating manner, the when I first looked at this, when I first started looking at school trust land, and you look at these, each school trust section is about 3 miles apart, so I always looked at it as, you know, every kid in a township would only be 3 miles away from school, so that's where they would actually have their schoolhouses and stuff. Well, it didn't take too long to realize that's actually not exactly what the lands were set aside for. They're not just for schoolhouses. They're actually for economic drivers for public education. So.
And that 3 miles, Director, was all uphill, too, right?
It was, yeah, in a snowstorm as well. We also ended up with three other grants from the federal government in the mid-1800s. We ended up with the Swamp Trust grant or the Swampland grant. The state actually had to sue for the indemnity lands. So when school trust lands, Section 16, were underwater, already part of a reservation, or had been sold, the federal government actually replaced those with indemnity lands or in lieu lands. And we also ended up with internal improvement lands. So the totals there, the original school sections in the indemnity lands, the Section 16 and 36, that was 2.9 million acres. The swampland grant in 1860, the trust actually received those lands, or the state received those lands a little bit later on after we identified them in the early 1900s. That was 4.7 million acres, and then the internal improvement lands were roughly 500,000 acres. So on the right-hand side of the slide, I show a Section 16 and a Section 36 in a township. Everything that's on that little depiction there, that map, is school trust lands. It's in purple. Section 1636 is the original school. Everything else on there is pretty much swamp trust. That's under our state law, all of those lands are considered school trust lands, even though they came from the four different federal grants. So what does the school trust look like now? We've converted the majority of that 8.1 million acres in mineral interest. We've converted it to a financial asset. That financial asset is worth $1.2 billion. 80% of that has come from mineral royalty payments. 9% of it is from the sale of real estate. 7% is from forest products, timber sales and things. And then the investments are another 4%. So the market value right now of the financial asset is $1.2 billion. The latest report that SBI has out is from September 30th of 2016. So that's the most current information that we have. We still have another asset in the trust, and that's the remaining 2.5 million acres of a unified estate or a united estate where we have a surface and a mineral estate. And we also have a split estate or a severed estate where we have 1 million acres of severed mineral interest where the school trust does not actually control the surface, but we retained our mineral rights. Those changes were made in Minnesota in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where the state actually started to reserve its mineral rights once we recognized what those mineral rights were worth. So just a little bit of breakdown on that. From that 2.5 million acres that we have, 957,000 of it is from the original school trust grant, Section 16 and 36. We have 1.5 million acres of swamp lands and about 6,500 acres of internal improvement lands. The map that's just under there shows you where most of these lands are consolidated. They're in northeastern Minnesota. 2.2 million of the 2.5 million acres are in northeastern Minnesota, and the majority of the lands are within 10 counties in northeastern Minnesota. So I usually do this slide first, but I wanted to give a little bit of that background and history before I got here. When Minnesota was established as a state, when we accepted these lands under the Enabling Act in 1858, the Constitution created a trust responsibility for the state on how these lands were managed. So all decision makers that are making decisions on behalf of the school trust are actually fiduciary. They have a fiduciary responsibility as a trustee. Every trust has a beneficiary. Those beneficiaries today are roughly 832,000 students in K-12 education. The duties that we as decision makers owe these kids are, first, to act with undivided loyalty to the trust. And what does that mean? That means that the state can't make decisions with school trust assets that pursue other state goals. We have to work on behalf of education and these, you know, 832,000 kids. We have to do what's right for our current beneficiaries and the future beneficiaries. This is a perpetual trust. It will last long after I'm gone. And I'll just leave it at that. But we have to act solely for these beneficiaries and the future beneficiaries. The another duty that I like to point out is the state has a duty to make the trust property productive. That means we have to manage the lands and lease the lands to produce income. Otherwise, we're not actually doing our fiduciary responsibility on behalf of the trust. The trust also has, or the trustees have a duty to pay income to the beneficiaries. We have a duty to pay income to current beneficiaries, and we have a duty to manage the lands in a conservative way so that we can pay income to future beneficiaries as well. And then the last one that I wanted to bring up was really we have to manage these trust assets on behalf of the beneficiaries under the trust mission. So what's the trust mission in the state? And that's you know, not just to provide economic benefits for education, but again, it's both current beneficiaries and future beneficiaries. So this is the state policy. It's in Minnesota Statute 127A31. It's been around for a while. And, you know, what it says is, you know, you have to secure the maximum long-term economic return throughout, you know, by employing your fiduciary responsibilities and with sound natural resource conservation and management principles and other specific policies provided by law. I will tell you that this policy causes a lot of heartburn. What does it mean? How do you define it? That was one of the first things I did in my first role in my second role in DNR when I was actually the DNR school trust land administrator right before I took this job. I will tell you, DNR is still working on defining the state policy. What does it mean? What does sound natural resource conservation and management principles mean? I'll tell you what I think it means. And the short of it for me is that you have to manage these school trust assets, the real estate, the timber, the minerals, in a way that is sustainable long term. It actually provides long term sustainable economic benefits to the trust. So how do you do that? And it's, you know, you have management strategies that produce multiple revenue streams off of each parcel. Based on that parcel's resources, so that your uses today or your management today doesn't, while you're producing some income, it doesn't detract from future revenue sources as well, unless you're actually converting it. If you're converting it to a financial asset, then the income comes from the financial investments. So, you know, one of the ways you have to look at this, I think, or the way I look at it is, you know, it's the long-term economic return from the lands before they're converted to cash. So how do you, you know, when I look at multiple revenue streams, you know, the one example that I can think of that I actually kind of like, I'll tell you, it's not my, it wasn't my idea. I was in a conference in Montana a few years ago now. And Montana was actually leasing some of their lands, some of their school trust lands for mountain bike trails. Well, I was a mountain biker. I am a mountain biker. That's a pretty neat concept. So, you know, you look and we have great mountain bike trails at Cuyuna Country. We have actually trails on some school trust stockpiles. We're not getting a lease payment for them, but there was a new opportunity in right outside of Grand Rapids in Cohasset on the Tioga Pit, and they wanted to develop a mountain bike trail there. That mountain bike trail is on school trust stockpiles. So not only are we selling and we're having multiple uses or multiple revenue streams from that stockpile through the sale of aggregates and the sale future sale of lean ore, but we're also getting a current lease payment, or we will be getting a current lease payment for the development of that mountain bike trail. So haven't divested of the resource. We haven't divested of the real estate. It's right on the Lake Pekegama. But we're getting those revenue streams, and we're getting those multiple revenue streams from that parcel. So I think that's how you actually maximize those lands. I think that's how you make sense of what sound natural resource conservation and management principles are. I think that's a prime example, because you're getting those multiple streams.
Director Van Leeuwen, I have a quick question with regards to that. These two slides and maximizing the long-term economic return, and I know you alluded it's been somewhat controversial at times in making decisions. Have there been court cases that have been brought forward with regards to school trust lands and how they're managed?
Mr. Chair, members, there have been a number of court cases, none in Minnesota as far as I know. I think the one case in Minnesota that I know about was an independent school district case that dealt with the public sale requirement of school trust lands in Minnesota and whether or not condemnation met that sale. I can't remember the case right off the top of my head. There have been other states, mainly in the West, that have had a number of lawsuits, Utah in particular, where they've actually looked at what does it mean to manage these trusts, what does the trust relationship require of its fiduciaries and its trustees.
Thank you.
So as I said, you know, this is this policy's caused a lot of heartburn and a lot of consternation on how to implement it, how to manage under that policy. And the legislature in 2012 look to make some changes and actually to, I think, help. And to help the DNR, who maintains control of these lands or administrative control of these lands. And what happened in 2012, this, I can tell you, was a compromise on what was originally, with the bill that was originally presented. But the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission was created, and my position as the School Trust Lands Director was created. Both of these positions were created to be advisors and an advisory role to the DNR and its land management activities or trust management activities. As you know, the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission is made up of six House members and six senators, six from the majority party, six from the minority party. And their job and their role, I believe, is to advise the rest of the legislature on all things school trust lands, to bring policies, legislative policies forward that will actually improve the trust assets or the allocation of the trust assets, and provide DNR some management advice. My role is very similar to their role. My role is actually to not only provide some legislative proposals, but to actually work with the commission on how those legislative policies would be presented and what legislative policies would be presented. I am not a legislative branch employee. I'm an executive branch employee. So I was appointed by the governor. There was nobody in this role for the 3 years between 2012 and 2015. So as I said, I'm the first of my kind. Took a little while to get here, but the it's a difficult role to be an advisor. I'll tell you, I'll just leave it at that for now. It's a difficult role, but you know, my job really is to advise not only This will be funny. I got a restart notice on the computer over here, so we'll see. I'll just keep going. If it blanks out, it blanks out. The, you know, my job isn't just to advise and work with the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission, but to also advise the governor, to provide advice at the executive council meetings on all things school trust land and the land exchange board. So, while I'm an executive branch employee, I think I, you know, kind of straddle the fence there, and I have to provide some advice and recommendations and work with the legislature as well on some of these things. So my restart notice went away, so we'll see what happens. So a little bit more background. I alluded to it before. You know, this Department of Natural Resources maintained management or administrative duties of all the 2.5 million acres and the 1 million acres of school trust lands. You know, the legislature did make some changes to the DNR's management statutes. The DNR, they put in the statute under 84027 that the DNR now actually has to act with undivided loyalty. That wasn't in the statute before. That was one of the duties that I talked about before. They, you know, you added some language about managing efficiently, so the DNR has to reduce its cost and maximize the revenues coming from school trust lands. Again, made reference to managing with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. And then another piece that was added into the DNR statute was that DNR needs to, when they're doing their management, they have to balance the short-term revenue gains so that long-term revenue opportunities aren't lost. And you know, I think that's important because, again, we're a perpetual trust. We have to look at, you know, providing income today. We also have to look at preserving or conserving the lands and the resources so that we have revenue for future beneficiaries. You know, the commission, I don't know why I still have that one up there, but you know, when I look at how we, in my office or as the director, how we work through some of those things, the legislature gave my role the opportunity to hire five people, or up to five staff, serving an unclassified service. I think I have similar duties, even though they're not spelled out in the statute, to be efficient and manage my costs and see if we can actually provide the best benefit to the beneficiaries as possible and really be value-added. And that's the way I'm trying to approach this. I know that's kind of a buzzword these days or buzz term, but it's, you know, how can we be value-added? And the way I've approached that really is, you know, how we're spending the money that's appropriated to us, how can I actually ensure that there's a return on that investment and that we're actually doing something for the beneficiaries?
Director Van Der Linde.
Yes, sir.
Representative Swazinski has a question.
Thank you, Chairman Fabian. Appreciate your testimony so far. Just kind of a question. We kind of mentioned a few times, really, on the management of the school trust land and preserving the natural resource. You know, those are decisions you're making kind of as an agency from your mission statement. You know, as a farmer, you know, I would, if I'm asked to do that by the government, you know, they have programs like CRP where they want to conserve my land. They would pay me for that. What payments are you asking from other government agencies to help you do that? So, you know, if I'm going to set aside my acres, so say that the school trust land could be a mine, whether it be policy decisions or whatever, what other state agencies are essentially paying you to set aside for the school trust for the benefit of those students to do that?
Director,
are you receiving any other payments? I mean, from other agencies to essentially set that land aside as you would like a private landowner?
Director.
Chairman, Representative Swedinsky, and members, I'll tell you point blank, there has been no payments made. The statute that was changed in 2012 did require a payment. I want to go back to one of the way you started your question, though, and you said preserve your lands. What are you getting paid to preserve your lands? I'll tell you, and then I think a second later you said conserve, and I think that's the misnomer. There's a difference between conservation and preservation. Conservation is the sustainable use of your resources for long-term benefits. That's what we're charged with, is the sustainable use of those resources for the long term, not preservation. If we're asked to preserve the lands and there's management, you know, prohibitions put on the lands, then there has to be a payment made. And the statute actually says in 84027 that if any future designations are made, a payment has to be made before those designations can be implemented. So that's in law right now. The statute in 2012 also addressed some of the former prohibitions on the lands. And we worked through a report and did an analysis back in 2012 and 2013 and submitted that to the legislature. I'll tell you, the amount that's owed to the trust is somewhere in the $75, $85 million range. And that's for the just the prohibitions where you can't make any revenue off of the lands.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so that would be that analysis of that $75 million, would that be the maximum output? So say there was a mine there, and it was producing gold, but instead it's, you know, there's prohibitions against doing anything on that. Even maybe that'd be for the next 5 years or 10 years that prohibition exists. That potential is there that it could be a mine. Has that analysis been made? That difference, you say $75 million of what's owed just to set that land aside. If there were a mine on that property and what the economic benefit to the school trust would be, has that difference been calculated?
Director Bandlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedinsky, and members, it's interesting that you bring that up because the way the analysis was done to reach that $75 million, $85 million number, we actually identified where our high-value mineral estate was, and we determined that we would not sever that estate. So what I mean that we're not going to sell the surface and encumber the minerals anymore by selling that surface. And just as an example, there was roughly 17,500 acres of old-growth forest that were identified. That was a prohibition. Of that acreage, roughly 17,000 of it is over a high-value mineral estate. So the compensation number that we are looking to get paid for that is actually just the timber value. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to sever the state. So technically, we're asking for a rotation age payment today. But we'd be asking for a rotation age payment today, knowing that the estate's not going to be severed, and that, again, that's a current revenue stream. You're not divesting of your resource, which is the valuable minerals underneath, so we would have those available later on. So we did not do that calculation of what that quote-unquote mine, any mine, would be worth, because we know that there are valuable minerals there. We just... Does that answer your question?
I think you just come up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that answer. So it sounds like the $75 million always scratches the surface of the issue.
Director Vanderlyn, care to take a whack at that? Just sure. Scratching the surface. There's something under the surface, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swidensky and members, I appreciate the pun.
he didn't mean it.
I don't think it scratches the surface. I think if you look at that 17,000 acres of old growth forest, the DNR has gone through an analysis over the last year to determine what those values really were. If memory serves, I haven't seen the final report, but if memory serves, that old growth forest is valued at about $19 million. And again, that old growth is there now, and that designation's there now. That doesn't mean that designation can't be lifted if there's a valuable mineral discovery to be found there. So I guess the easy way to describe it is that if we can't mine those minerals later on because of the old growth designations, then yes, we should be looking for a payment at a later date. But right now, we don't know that where all those minerals are. And right now, they're not over known mineral deposits. So,
thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you'll get to this later in your presentation, but... Part of that $80 million is basically, in my understanding, is catch-up dollars, because we've got a fair number of acreage that is currently being used in a manner that produces no resource, no direct resource to the trust fund, and most of it's being managed by the DNR. And it escapes me now how many public accesses on lakes our school trust land, and that's an example where we need to look at making some adjustment here so that that property that's not going to, and I'm certainly not suggesting we start charging folks to go to those particular lakes, but we need to look at like shifting that acreage out of that system, trading it, or simply going out and buying it. As I remember, there's a significant amount of those dollars we looked at. This is what it would cost if you purchased what those kids own, but are being used for something that isn't producing a nickel of money for the corpus. But you're going to get into that here later. That I know that may be a little too detailed for those that aren't familiar with this, but it's really important because it's expensive.
Director, proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick and members, I did not plan on getting into that on the compensation model. I can tell you I agree with you. They are catch-up dollars. There's roughly 200 water access sites that are situated on school trust lands throughout the state. They are in varying degrees of development, varying degrees of lakes. I know the DNR's valuation process that they went through actually set those different water access sites down into different tiers, and I don't know that they'll testify on that tomorrow. I know that DNR will be here tomorrow to talk about that. I don't know that they have the values situated yet, because I think what they're working on is actually going out and appraising a sampling of those different types of water access sites so we can get a better handle on what that value is. But
proceed.
Thank you. So just back to this, and, you know, again, DNR has management control. The commission and my office are set up as advisors, and I think it's important to point out that, you know, it's critical that this triad functions and that we support each other's work because we're all working for the same goal, or we should all be working for the same goal. And, you know, I just want to point it out that it is critical that we all work together, that we all try to advance the ball, if you will, on behalf of the school kids. And, again, we have a duty for undivided loyalty. We have a duty to manage for income. We have a duty to follow the mission. So leave it at that and move on. I wanted to get into my statutory duties real quick. I'll tell you the way I look at this is really this is my job description. This is what I'm supposed to be working on. Just real quickly, I'm supposed to be developing legislative policy initiatives, evaluating the land asset, both its current market value and its potential market value. I have to determine, you know, really what the value of all of the assets are, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. We have to develop a 10-year strategic plan, and we have to, you know, actually develop also along with that as a 25-year framework on how we're going to manage those. And then I'm also set up to advise the DNR on its management and its management of all things from sales and exchanges to royalty agreements to forestry cost certification, et cetera. Few things that, you know, just touching on that legislative policy piece. Again, I'm an executive branch employee. Not this statute, but a different statute says that I need to submit my policy and budget proposals to both the governor's office and the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission. I do that each year. Last year, really grabbed some low-hanging fruit, I think, on behalf of the trust and worked with the commission on that. We made some modifications to the minerals management account and how that fund was swept and how the revenue is supposed to get to the fund faster for quicker investments. We sought to take advantage of the expedited land exchange law that was only available to the counties currently, but now it has been you know, given to the trust so that the trust can take advantage of the expedited land exchange law. In a sense, would improve the timing and the processing of a land exchange from a number of years to 18 months maybe. We have also got some authority to do some real estate development analysis and implementation in coordination with the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission. And from an administrative standpoint, I have authority to enter into joint powers agreements and to interagency agreements and to act as the trustee in condemnation actions. So back to Representative Swedinsky's question, when we, you know, talk about when those lands are being used and being preserved and the trust isn't actually being compensated, we have that state has an obligation to compensate. Usually that's through a condemnation action in court. I got authority last year that I would actually serve as the temporary trustee to make the decision to make sure that the trust was being fully compensated under that condemnation award. For this legislative session, I don't think you've seen anything from my office yet. I learned last week that my requests for policy and budget proposals were not advanced by the governor's office. I had presented them earlier in December to the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission, and really they were pretty simple. One was to fund some of the Boundary Waters work. I'll talk about that later. And then I had a couple of policy pieces on reinvesting in reforestation. I will talk about that a little bit later as well when I get to my looking ahead statement. So, you know, I look at this as my job description, really. I look at, you know, this is how we should approach our job. As I said before, I try to be efficient and cost-effective with the appropriations that have been granted to our office. The appropriations that come to my office are actually from school trust resources, school trust revenues, and I want to make sure that we provide a return on that investment. So to that end, I've worked with DNR to advance, you know, a couple of different positions in DNR and working with them and partnering with them on a couple of positions. I'll talk about one a little bit. But I also hired two staff. I have 1.5 employees. They're in the audience today. They're sitting up in the audience. I hired one as a business development analyst. He's been a godsend. And I hired a former employee that I actually stole from admin when I was at DNR. And she's working half-time for us. And she has been just as valuable as Mark has in developing this, doing this real estate evaluation and working on some of our boundary waters work. So just wanted to kind of let them know that I appreciate all their work in front of everybody today. So,
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's on this slide with the 10-year strategic plan and the 25-year strategic framework. And I know, you know, we in the legislature create commissions and boards, and wondering the authority within the commission or in your position. For those two things, have you started them? Are they in process? Is that something you do in-house, or do you do a contracting out for that to facilitate that?
Director Vanderlyn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, members, you're a couple slides ahead of me, but I'll answer the question. Yes, we have started working on it. We've started framing up the what we're looking at for the strategic plan. And I'll jump ahead, and then I'll go back to it. And really, what I'm looking at here for the strategic plan is, you can't do any business planning or strategic planning until you actually know what your assets are. So that's looking ahead. What we're actually looking to do is complete our inventory, and that's what we've been working on this last year and a half is working through more of our inventory analysis so we can actually do that.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, my question is maybe a little different. Did you do a request for proposals to do the 10-year plan, or are you doing that internally? Is that a stakeholder process, or is that a public process? I understand what you're doing. I think that's a good thing. I'm just wondering how and your authority on doing that.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, members, the statute actually requires us to coordinate with DNR on the development of the strategic plan. Once we have our inventory completed and kind of honed in a little bit, we're looking right now at doing an RFP to have an outside consultant come in and actually help us develop some of that strategic plan.
But follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your leeway here, but I think you know where I'm going. So is it, when you do that, do you anticipate having public meetings, or is it only a stakeholder process?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, members, we haven't made that determination yet, but we will definitely take that into consideration. Right now I'm only envisioning stakeholder meetings. That's how we've set everything up. But if you feel that it's, you know, important or prudent to actually go through some public meetings, I would take that advice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's always better to get the public involved rather than just the stakeholders. And I think having regional dispersion of meetings, too, also brings in better input.
Thank you. Director, if I may, two members, we do have a number of things on our agenda for today. If we could hold questions until the end, if that's okay, and then, Director, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, you know, going back to, you know, how I look at my job and where to start, one of the things that I did when I was originally in my school trust position at DNR was we went through a risk analysis, and we actually identified 88 risks with school trust management. And again, I look at that as, how are we going to manage these risks to serve the beneficiaries the best? So out of those 88 risks, they were in these three different fields, core real estate assets, your forest management risks, and your mineral revenue risk. Of those 88, 56 of those 88 risks were identified as risks with a likelihood of significant impact to the trust. And of those 56, only 16 of them had key controls. So there are 40 risks with significant impacts, or the likelihood of having significant impacts, that have no controls, have no key controls to manage the risk. So when I look at that, where do I start? That is one thing that we need to start working on, and that's one thing we needed to start working on as advisors last year, and that's what we've done. And really focused on three of them to begin with. One of the first was on our forest management side with our dual certification under the Forest Stewardship Council and Sustainable Forestry Initiative. And we've done an analysis on that. A second piece was construction aggregates, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, and then also our real estate evaluation and how we actually come up with our market value. So with that, I'd ask Matt Payne from Minnesota Analysis and Development to come up and actually talk about our program evaluation for forest certification. You know, when we originally looked at this program and how we actually looked at dual certification, you know, we know that we have this quote-unquote, or need, as a trust, we need this social license to cut by maintaining dual certification. We know we have that so that we can operate in the state. But how do we quantify the benefits to the trust? Or how do we quantify the benefits to the beneficiaries for that? You know, and what is the long-term economic benefit for maintaining dual certification on Minnesota's trust lands? So, again, to Representative Hansen's point, you know, we actually did not think that we were impartial enough to do that ourselves. And we looked to an RFP, an outside company, to do that for us, or an outside group to do that, and we actually worked with Matt Kane and Minnesota Analysis and Development to do that analysis for us. They did that over the course of 6 or 9 months, I believe, produced a report for us, and I'll tell you, I'll cut to the chase, we still have some work to do on it, but with that, I'll turn it over to Matt.
Mr. Impartial Kane. Identify yourself for the record, please, and who you represent.
I'm Matt Kane. I'm a consultant with the State of Minnesota's Management Analysis and Development Division. We are a unit within state government that provides services to agencies and the broader public sector. And as Aaron indicated, STL, Turn to Management Analysis and Development, or MAD, as we are tragically known as, turned to us for some research and analysis on this study of forest certification. We looked at three key research questions for the report. The first was, what is a reasonable estimate for STL's cost of forest certification? The second was, does forest certification increase the price that's paid to STL for timber? And the third is, do companies that buy timber from STL need certification, certified timber from the trust to meet the demand for product from their customers? Allow me to just quickly sum up the findings from the, about forest certification's impacts on STL as they relate to these three issues of costs, revenues, and markets, and then I'll go a little deeper into that. Let me start with the costs of, from certification charges. Forest certification charges to STL in fiscal 2015 are estimated at about $95,000 for direct costs, and then that increases to about $174,000 if you include certification-related expenditures for general operations and administration. In terms of STL costs from foregone revenues, reasonable but imprecise estimates of the annual foregone STL revenues from harvest restrictions and reserve requirements range pretty widely from a low of $25,000 for reserve and restrictions specifically related to the forest certification and the requirements that those organizations have, on up to the imprecise high estimate of $422,000 for restrictions and reserve requirements tied to forest certification standards, but also to DNR policies on how they manage school trust lands. So some of that may relate to certification, some of it may not. In terms of the price premium, the study finds that forest certification likely doesn't yield a price premium for STL or DNR timber. with other market factors undermining the positive price pressures that you would get from that certification. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then finally, on the need for certification, the representatives of Minnesota's paper and pulp industry cited a clear need for certified timber. Paper and pulp accounts for about 70% of the STL timber that is sold. And meanwhile, representatives from the lumber mills, so the wood side of it, had no preference for certification. So let me offer a little more detail on those points. First, with regard to forest certification charges to STL, the $95,000 in direct forest certification charges that fell to STL or estimated to have fallen to STL in fiscal 2015 amount to just over 1% of the total forestry costs borne by STL that year. They include, you know, staff hours that are coded for certification, its contract costs for recertification, surveillance audits that happen as part of that, and then fees paid to the certification organizations. And we split up costs throughout this study. We said, you know, what percent of the land that DNR is managing is STL? It's about 45%. What's DNR's? It's the rest. And so we split the costs as a 45% to the STL. Now, if we look beyond the direct charges and include the indirect administration and general operations expenditures, the estimated cost to STL for forest certification charges amounts to just under the $175,000 for fiscal 2015, and that's about 2% of STL's forestry costs. The second consideration when it comes to certification costs is estimating the foregone timber harvests and revenues. And this one gets tricky. So, as I mentioned at the start, a reasonable but imprecise initial estimate using DNR data showed that the foregone revenue to STL from harvest restrictions and reserve requirements fall within a wide range. And the low, again, is at $25,000 for fiscal 2015 to a high of about $422,000. Mm-hmm. The low $25,000 estimate is for harvest restrictions and reserve requirements specifically related to the forest certification guidelines of the Forest Stewardship Council and the Sustainable Forest Initiative. So those are the certification organizations. And this is a pretty solid estimate. We know the two types of harvest restrictions and reserve requirements used in managing STL forests and tied directly to those forest certification requirements, and we could run the numbers taking that into account. And so that $25,000 is from foregone revenues is our low-end estimate. The much, much higher $422,000 estimate for foregone revenues factors in other restrictions and reserve requirements on school trust lands, and those are from the certification and also from DNR policy and state law affecting harvests in several, a state law affecting harvest setbacks in several Minnesota counties. If STL operates without any harvest restrictions and reserve requirements, other than the need to sustain a harvest into the future, that is. So in this case, you've got no reserves and restrictions tied directly to the forest certification. That's an easy one to set aside. But then you've also got none in place based on the current DNR policy. Then you get that estimate that shows that STL's annual reserves and fiscal revenues, excuse me, in fiscal 2015 would have risen by as much as $422,000. Now, with regard to that high end, and you can tell from the language I'm using, that $422,000 estimate, let me just make clear that that is an imprecise estimate. To get there, we use DNR data calculating the timber revenues if you hypothetically remove the restrictions. This gave a maximum harvest of timber, you know, in keeping with above rotation age and across all the cover types. And so in terms of our estimate for foregone revenues from STL, the $422,000 represents the highest possible cost of that foregone revenues, as high as they could have been in fiscal 2015. Now, that's not a lot of precision. When you're talking between $25,000 and $422,000, that's a big range. That's a 17 times from the low to the high. So what's going on here? Well, the high estimate wasn't meant to be a firm estimate, but should be viewed as an upper range or a ceiling, if you will, for that possible loss from the harvesting. We didn't attempt a precise estimate for the high end because to be able to do so, you would need to identify which of all of the reserves and restrictions stemming from DNR policy matter to Forest certification, because you could argue, and it's a reasonable argument, that some of what's put in place matters to the folks who are doing the certification. They say, oh, this is good, that's good. So, you know, what matters, what doesn't. Currently, there is an agreement on this. There is not agreement on this point. So which ones matter to Forest certification? Well, from the one side, the answer right now could be only those that are required by the certification organizations. But on the other side, it could be all those that are required by the DNR policies. So it's impossible to say with certainty how many of the restrictions and reserve requirements tied to DNR policies affect the forest certification and the harvests. So a more precise estimate would be possible, but for those better estimates, the next and necessary step would be to identify which of the reserves and restrictions beyond those tied specifically to FSC and SFI requirements are relevant to forest certification, and then reasonably include those in a more detailed analysis. DNR would then be able to produce some numbers, and we could look at the lost revenue incorporating that information. So that is the very long story on the foregone revenue. A couple of other points from the study. The second important thing that we looked at was that school trust lands likely capture no price premiums for the certified timber. When DNR adopted certification for forests in 2015, many of the industry leaders and state officials expected certified timber would command a price premium. You'd get more for it if you had it. However, the consensus among the industry representatives and experts interviewed for this study is that forest certification yields little or no price premium to STL and DNR for their timber. They said that certification has not increased stumpage prices paid to DNR and STL or the prices paid to the mills for paper and pulp and lumber products, except in some limited cases. Officials with the certification agencies themselves or organizations themselves, FSC and SFI, emphasize a range of positive outcomes from certification, but they acknowledge the positive impacts from certification on timber prices are hard to track and not common. And there's a lot of reasons for that once we got into this and looked at it. You know, it's the supply. There's a lot of supply of certified timber. It's the decline in the paper and pulp industry. It's an unwillingness of consumers to pay more for certified product. There are some price dynamics in that market. And remember, too, that certification doesn't affect the quality of the wood. It's harder to charge a lot more when the quality isn't different. And so there's those kinds of factors going on. The third area we looked at is the industry's need for STL certified timber. Representatives from Minnesota's paper and pulp mills expressed a clear need for certified timber, but again, on the lumber mill side, they didn't need the certified timber to meet customer demand. Importantly, this split between the paper and pulp industry needing the certified timber and the lumber mills having no preference is likely an important one for STL, because our analysis of the sales records found that about 70% of the STL timber that was sold to paper and pulp mills from the 2012 to 2015 period. So the paper and pulp mills account for a relatively small number of the businesses that are buying the timber, but they account for a huge share of what's being sold. Another point worth mentioning is almost all of those interviewed advise that STL should keep the forest certification in some form, because certification offers a social license that allows the industry to harvest trees and produce products without environmental backlash. And then I've got just two really quick additional points from the research for the study. The first is about the industry attitudes towards the types of certification. Interviews with industry representatives from the four primary forest product companies in Minnesota that we talked to indicated a preference among paper and pulp mills for timber certification under both FSC and SFI. But among the lumber mills, again, there was really no preference on the certification. And then the second quick point I want to make is that forest certification market access. We talked about how there isn't a price impact, but the industry representatives and experts who were interviewed said that the forest certification provides access to markets for paper and pulp producers, and that this access to market is what drives the demand for STL certified timber from Minnesota's Minnesota's mills. So that's my quick tour of the forest certification study. I do have executive summaries that I brought along. To review, the forest certification does impose costs on STL. The direct costs are pretty easy to estimate. The cost for foregone revenues is harder to nail down currently. Forest certification likely doesn't boost STL timber prices, and paper and pulp producers in Minnesota say they need the certified timber for their mills, and I hope this quick rundown has been helpful.
Mr. Kane, thank you. I appreciate your hard work into this and digging into it. Much appreciated. Director Van der Linde.
Mr. Chair, I saw Representative Eklund had his hand up.
Oh. You know, if we can, I'd like to wait, Representative, okay? I really do want to make sure that we get completed with our testimony today. I know that there's someone sitting behind you that has driven almost as far as what I drive to get here, so I want to make sure that we have time for that.
Right.
Please proceed and try to wrap up if you can.
Sure. I will.
So we do have time for questions.
Definitely. Just a couple more things that we worked on in FY16 from the School Trust Lands Office. As I said, I partnered with DNR on hiring an aggregate geologist, paid for that position for two years now, FY16 and FY17. You know, I think it's been a great use of our money. They've actually advanced the aggregate analysis in Minnesota on school trust lands. Last year, they had a goal of analyzing 9,000 parcels. They got to almost 12,000 parcels. And, you know, they have the same goals for FY17, and I think they're on track with that as well. So we're advancing that. They actually taken a different approach on how they're approaching the analysis. And, you know, we're looking at short-term and long-term revenues for the trust. So the way they're looking at it from the short-term piece is, they're trying to marry up their analysis with current MnDOT road projects and then finding school trust aggregate deposits around those MnDOT projects. And they have goals of, you know, finding those deposits next to those projects and leasing at least two or three new leases a year on school trust lands. Another big undertaking from FY16 that Susan Mackey took on for our office was evaluating the real estate part of our statutory duty is to come up with the current market value and a potential market value of our school trust lands of that 2.5 million acres. I'll tell you, out of the 87 counties in Minnesota, we have school trust lands in 57 of them. Of that 57, there's 27 counties that have less than 100 parcels or less than 4,000 acres. So when we're looking at those parcels, where are our lands and why do we own lands in certain counties are questions that we're starting to ask. I'm remiss to tell you what the actual value is that what we've analyzed so far because I don't want it to kind of shock you. But one of the approaches is how we're getting there is looking at actually the county assessed values of what all of our school trust lands are worth. So we've gotten through the majority of the counties. We have about 20 of the 57 left to do, and we have a pretty big number right now on real estate values just from an assessment standpoint. So looking ahead at our strategic plan, back to Representative Hansen's question earlier, we do have to complete our inventory before we can do that. And when I was at DNR and DNR undertook an inventory back in 2012 and 2013, I led that project. And we went through six categorizations for a highest and best use inventory. My office is actually drilling down into that inventory a little bit further. I guess the way we're looking at it is, okay, if we say we have 1.5 million acres of productive forest in Minnesota, well, I want to know now how many acres of that are our high value timber like aspen and birch and things of that nature, and then how many of those acres are actually within 75 miles of a mill. So those are the most profitable lands. So that's some of the work that we're actually working on. And, you know, when I look at these lands as well, you know, I'm going back to that, you know, big number of what our real estate evaluation is. We're looking at this school trust assets really is the, you know, we have the financial asset as $1.2 billion, and we have the 2.5 million acres of land and 1 million acres of severed mills. We're looking at it from a whole trust concept. So we need to determine what that 2.5 million acres is worth. We have to determine what all the real estate's worth, what all the timber is potentially worth, and what all the minerals are potentially worth. So that we actually have a trust that is, we can say, our trust has these assets and they are worth X. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to guess it's probably going to be somewhere in the $4 or $5 billion range, if not higher. And that's just a rough guess, but I think our trust is worth probably well over $5 billion if you include all of its assets. The the other piece that we're going to be looking at really from the strategic plan is a divestiture analysis and what we actually need to do to analyze those parcels that we should divest of, either through a land sale or through a land exchange, or why would we, why do we own these certain parcels? Those are, I guess that's the easiest way to ask the question is, why do we own this parcel? Why do we own 1.6 acres in Yellow Medicine County? You know, why do we have two parcels in Martin County? You know, we don't, you know, those things actually cost management dollars to manage. It's a drain on the trust. So why we need to ask those questions, why do we own them? And the other piece that we're looking at, and just to back up real quick, the map that's on this slide is actually the map from the DNR Lands and Minerals geologist that they gave me in a quick quarterly report of how they're actually looking at the school trust lands around those MnDOT projects, and that's a 10-mile radius around those around those MnDOT projects, so you can actually maximize the aggregate values. So looking ahead for, as I said, we're looking at this from a whole trust concept. What do we need to do to make sure that we're maximizing our revenues? Mentioned earlier, we're going to do phase two of that dual certification study. As Mr. Kane said, we really didn't, we have too big of a range. The way I look at it is, you know, it's clear to us that we need dual certification in Minnesota. The mills have told us we need dual certification. Those mills take about 65-70% of our wood. They tell us we need it. We need that relationship. We need them to manage our forest. That's how we have a long-term benefit to the trust, is maintaining a healthy forest. We need the mills to cut those, take that wood. The question that I have is, what's a reasonable cost of doing business for the trust? Is it 2% of the cost, or is it 7% of the cost, or is it somewhere in between? So we really need to hone in on what the actual costs are, to what Representative Swedinsky asked earlier. You know, when you're setting aside lands, is somebody paying for it? Right now, there's no payments. So we need to figure out what a reasonable cost of doing business is, and if it's over that reasonable cost, is there a payment that's going to be made? Another thing that we're excited about is, you know, this woody biomass program and the concept that we're working on with that. We're looking at our school trust lands. When I look at all of our school trust timber sales, a woody biomass is an option on all of our school trust timber sales. But 90% of that woody biomass, it's a resource that can be used, 90% goes unsold at $1 a ton. So we have an underutilized resource. How do you maximize revenues? You get multiple revenue streams, or all the revenue streams that you can. You make the best use of your resource. Woody biomass right now is an underutilized resource. So we have actually gone through an RFP process, hired a company out of Vermont, Bioenergy Economy Resource Center, to do a concept paper for the state to look at what our opportunities are for a woody biomass project in the state. And that actually has a number of different outcomes that I think, or directions that will come from that, and we'll be making recommendations after we get that concept paper. But looking at it right now, we have a few hundred tons of underutilized resource right now from just the initial work that that they've done. And then, I mentioned it earlier as one of the policy proposals is reinvesting in reforestation. Right now, school trust lands and actually all of DNR lands are lagging in reforesting the lands after they're harvested. Mostly that is historically been done through bonding dollars, and there haven't been bonding dollars for reforestation. I'll tell you briefly, my proposal was to actually reinvest school trust timber revenues into reforestation so that we had long-term economic drivers for the trust from reforestation. I think DNR had a very similar, if not the same, policy proposal, and I don't know the status of that. Looking ahead from the non-ferrous or the mineral development side, you know, I just got a notice yesterday, or actually last week, that DNR will be advancing its 2017 non-ferrous metallic mineral lease sale. I think that was published yesterday. Mr. Richards is in the audience. He can correct me if I'm wrong. The last time they did a lease sale was in 2015, and the Executive Council did approve those leases in March of 2016. So we need to continue with non-ferrous metallic mineral leases in the state. Those leases and that private investment is how we actually find where our minerals are in the state, where our high-value minerals are in the state, through private investment. If we don't have lease sales, we don't have private investment, we don't know where our minerals are, we don't know where our value is. So we rely on private investment for that solely. Another concept that we're working on is a mineral management zone, and actually looking at a mineral management zone around significant deposits or known deposits. Again, this is not a new idea. It's not my idea. It is the DNR Lands and Minerals idea. I'm borrowing it or stealing it with their permission and working with DNR Lands and Minerals staff on that. So when we look at, you know, these mineral management zones, we have, you know, a copper nickel resource in the state that could produce, you know, 50 to 100 years of mining in the state. That could turn out to be billions of dollars worth of royalty revenues for the school trust. And as I mentioned way, way back in the beginning, 80% of our revenue in that $1.2 billion asset has come from mineral royalties. So we can't overlook these deposits. We can't look at that. And the way we approach these is really through a risk assessment and identifying those risk assessments for those high-value minerals and looking at it at from a risk table of where the exceptional deposits are and ensuring that we've actually, if we can put our land there, we can consolidate our land there, but we're also making sure that we don't divest of any lands in that area. So real quick, I made it to BWC project update. You know, I've been leading this project since 2010, 2012. They told me, I make this joke every time, so if you've heard it, I'm sorry, but they tell me it's a career project, and I got about 20 years left in my career, so I hope I get it done before then, but the joke is, if I get it done within the next 5 years, do I get to retire early? And I think my wife would tell you no, but I'd like to retire earlier. So 2012, the state proposed the land exchange with the federal government in Superior National Forest. If you look on this map, everything that is red in the boundary waters is set for land exchange. Those are the parcels that are identified for land exchange. Do I have that right? Yeah. And everything that is yellow inside the boundary waters is set for federal acquisition. And then if you look outside in the Superior National Forest, the green sections are actually parcels that the school trust would obtain in the land exchange. The current status of that land exchange is we are at the appraisal stage. We've worked through a number of the appraisal issues, and the Forest Service will be hiring an appraiser, I would think, within the next 2 to 3 months. We've worked through the a lot of the issues with them on that. The Forest Service is also completing its environmental impact statement under NEPA. They went through the NEPA scoping process, made a determination a while back in September 2015 that they needed to do a full-blown EIS. I think that's actually a good idea because, as Representative Hansen said, it involved the public in the process all the way through. I'll tell you there have been questions before about whether or not the Forest Service could use its categorical exclusion option, and I believe they could have, but I don't think that that was a wise way to go. I think the EIS is the wiser way to go. It gets everything out and analyzed and opens it up for all the public comment periods. Might take a little longer, but I think we get a better product at the end. So the Forest Service will finish up its EIS sometime later this summer. We hope to have a draft record of decision in the fall of this year and a final record of decision sometime about this time in 2018, which would set us up to, I think, complete the exchange in late 2018, if not mid-2019. So that's the goal, is to finish the exchange that way. The sale is a different story. We have 30,000 acres that's going to be exchanged. We have roughly 51,000 acres that's set for the sale, and that requires federal appropriations. Every request that the Forest Service has put in front of the Washington office has been summarily rejected. Sometimes they haven't even gotten to Washington. This last round of funding requests has made it to Washington. I've made a number of trips with Commissioner Landwehr, Commissioner Jewell from St. Louis County, and even Paul Danisek from Friends of the Boundary Waters has been out there to help us lobby Congress and the Forest Service for these monies. What we didn't know years ago was that the Forest, Superior National Forest, can't lobby on behalf of itself to get this funding, so we have to do it for them. So we've been out trying to drum up support from this. I think we have great support from our congressional delegation. I know we have support from the legislature. I know we have support from a number of other stakeholders, a number of different letter-writing campaigns in support. I know the governor's office sent in a letter of support. The current funding option for federal fiscal 18 in October is for $12 million. That would buy roughly 15,000 acres of the 51 that needs to be bought. When we were out there in November, the day after the election, it's a great day in Washington, I'll tell you, we drove in and there was a cloud over the Capitol, literally a cloud over the Capitol. We were told that the most that they would fund it was $3 million. That's how much they fund it. So if you think about that, we need to come back about 10, 15 more times to actually buy out all those lands. The value of that 51,000 acres is somewhere around $50 million. So we're going to have to keep going back and keep going back and keep going back. So that might be the lifetime part of this project. So with that, I am done, except for this last slide shows the value of the fund at $1.2 billion and then the distributions and the revenues from the last few years, and I won't belabor the point and go through those.
Thank you, Director. We'll take some questions. Commissioner Sabina, would you come up to the table, please? I one time said on the House floor that I would never be as eloquent as Representative Van Zels, nor as charming as Representative Rukavina, so I'm anticipating a little charm here, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you for inviting me. And
you're welcome. Identify yourself for the record, please, and who you represent.
I'm Rukavina, and I'm a county commissioner in St. Louis County. And I used to be somebody, but now I'm just...
And I thought you were going to say I represent the school kids, but you didn't.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chair, I do have to point out that I got to use my briefcase for the first time, and Representative Lehman might recognize this briefcase because she gave it to me when she was the IRRB commissioner, and I never used it until today. And I'm not going to be, I don't have a slide presentation. What I do have is 26 years of frustration, and I got to pull it out here. I have saved everything. And in fact, my congressman had asked me if I could make copies of everything. I have to say that, but I have resolutions to Congress. I have bills creating the Children's Memorial Forest. I have letters to Congressman Oberstar and Senator Klobuchar and Senator Wellstone. And I'm going to try to be nice today to the DNR, Mr. Myers and Mr. Richards. although that might be difficult for me, so ahead of time I'm going to apologize to Croatia.
Members, and just so you know, I did tell Commissioner Riccovino that I was going to allow for a fair amount of latitude in this testimony today.
So, members, this is 26 years of frustration on this issue. And I have to start off by saying, actually 26 years ago this month, or 30 years ago this month, I had then Representative Loneman from Hibbing, my seatmate, ask me to offer an amendment in the Government Ops Committee, which I did, not knowing what as a freshman, you know. And boy, did I catch hell later on that day from the chair, two chairs of the the Education Committee and the Education Finance Committee. The Representative Wagenius knows the, at that time, the Policy Committee actually had the power and not the Finance Committees, and they were separate. So, you know, it all started because there were these leased lakeshore lots on school trust land, and there was a assistant DNR commissioner that, for whatever reason, didn't like it. And so they were jacking up the leases, and to the point that if you had a lease on state school trust land, you were now paying more for the lease than your neighbor who owned their cabin land real estate on some of the lakes up north. So there was an old lawyer here, and he actually worked for the DNR, and was as frustrated with this issue. This is 30 years ago. You're going to be an old man like me before maybe you get this done. Mr. Chair, I went to the back doctor yesterday. You remember I used to be a whopping 5'3". I'm now down to 5'1¼", and another inch and a quarter I'll officially be a midget, which is what Thomasonian them call me anyway. So, and I think Representative Metza uses it behind my back too. But so Mr. Ofelt kind of educated me on this. His name was Phil Ofelt. Gene is probably, Representative Wagenius is probably the only one that might remember Mr. Ofelt in the revisor's office. And he, as I said, had been previously a lawyer for the DNR. And, you know, in here I have so much information. I have a letter from Joe Alexander from 1981 yelling at the legislative auditor's paper that they put out on trust lands. And in it, he says, the draft audit report grossly exaggerates the extent to which trust lands have been devoted to non-income producing uses and ignores the fact that in nearly all cases that this has occurred, such as state parks, has been the result of legislative action, which is true. A lot of the lack of income in that to the school trust has been because as a legislature we've told them to do certain things that weren't conducive to what the trust I think is supposed to do. Here is a report that I got years and years ago after I really started digging into this issue, because a lot of my friends, we had an auction the first time the leases, state lease school trust lands went up, and the DNR said we had to go to an auction. And one of my dad's good working friends, Cully Griggs was his name, and they had grubbed all the stumps to make the roads into Kaptogama Lake, and they had a cabin on school trust land, and they lost it to a wealthy computer whiz who bid against them in the auction. And boy, the next auction, someone called up that was hot, anonymous phone calls before, you know, everybody had cell phones and you knew who was calling you, and made a threat. So then the second auction, we had to go through metal detectors. Representative Cornish, you'd like that, but I didn't like it, nor did most of my constituents. So I started digging in and seeing what the DNR was doing to raise money. Here's a little printout they gave me. It was from fiscal years 1977 to 1996. In that time period, the DNR sold $37 million worth of timber that the school kids owned. In the last 2 years, they finally put some money in the school trust. Out of $37 million worth of timber, they put $590,000 in the school trust and charged the kids just almost the entire amount for management and planting and everything else. Representative Eklund as a former county commissioner where there's a lot of, you have a lot of tax forfeited land. You know, this is a pretty outrageous thing. So now we're into the early 90s, and I kind of start raising a lot of heck around here and trying to get information. And, you know, here's another one that then-Senator Morris had put out where there were 100, counting the lands and the boundary waters, there were 172,566 acres of school trust land that belonged to the kids that was locked up, mostly the 93,000 acres in the boundary waters, but 14,000 in old growth, almost 8,000 in old growth candidates, 51,000 acres in scientific and natural areas, and 6,000 plus acres in state parks. And I don't know if that, maybe, you know, Aaron, you can tell me if that number has actually changed at all. Because this is from 20 years ago where I was asking, what's going on here to the DNR? You got to start, you know, paying for some of this land if that's what you want. So now it gets to the late 90s, and I'm really starting to go off half-cocked, which I actually mentioned in a letter to Senator Wellstone to please help me on this issue so I don't go off half-cocked. I actually put in a letter. But, you know, I've got letters here to Congressman Oberstar, and he tells me, Tom, why don't you get a resolution from the state and get a resolution to Congress? And so here's the resolution to Congress that passed the House, I think with 4 votes against it, and Representative Wagenius was on my side even. She voted for this resolution that was passed in 1999 to Congress to do a land exchange with the Boundary Waters checkerboard that you see up there. It passed the Senate unanimously, by the way, and there were only 4 votes against it in the House. So Congressman Oberstar says to me, you know, thank you. Thank you for that very strong vote, and we're going to start working on it, and nothing happens. We have all of a sudden a movement in Congress. Where they grab the number, I have no idea, but I've got news articles here where they picked a number of $10 million. I said, well, that's outrageous. So we had an appropriation. Senator, who helped me over in the Senate, because we were in the minority, but I think Senator Osmond helped me get $200,000 that was now going into the university trusts because they have a lot of mineral rights that they were making money off of from university trust lands. We did a study. We just did an appraisal on Trout Lake, which is north of Lake Vermilion in the separated part of the Boundary Waters, and we came up with a figure then in 2002 of $92 million that the NRI, the Natural Resource and Research Institute, did the appraisal. So, you know, I have letters here now when they were trying to do this half land, half money, and we're asking, where does it give you that right in the Constitution? And it doesn't. But statutorily, we had 2 bills as I left the legislature in 2012, representatives. And one bill had a directed an exchange of land for land, and the other one had this money for land. And I think the land for land one was passed last, if I'm not mistaken. I can get some help from the clerk here, who I think was around here then. Maybe you could check on that, Mr. Chair. But, you know, it would make sense that the last bill passed is what the DNR should do. So I don't know if that's happening or not. I know they're out there now. When it first started, I do have the figures here in a news article and from one of the commissioners then that I think it started out at 48,000 acres of the exchange. Then it went down to 43 and money. And now it is down to 37. So they've nicked away at it. Mr. Chair, you come from farm country. I come from, you know, where we farm rocks, and you know that
I farm trees in my area, too.
Yes, I know you do. We farm trees and rocks, and I think it was Will Rogers that said, buy land because God isn't making any more of it. So we've got these proposals up north now for a very big mill, Louisiana Pacific, where we could use timber, and I think Mr. Vanderland, who I say has done an excellent job, by the way. I'm of the opinion that Mr. Vanderland should have a lot more authority, and the DNR should have a lot less, because the DNR has done a lot of things that, and it's not their fault, they've done things that have directed them to use the trust to do other things that don't make money for the kids. And here's a, from 1981, a big study by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and on page 13, look, I got my notes yet from how many years ago. It says...
Is it written in Croatian?
No, it isn't. But I'll tell you what, it's so confusing, it might as well be. What it says here on page 14 is this. The potential for a conflict of priorities exists for the DNR in the management of the permanent school fund. An example was mentioned earlier. It is the lack of adequate compensation to the permanent school fund for use of its land. The DNR has restricted various parcels of permanent school fund lands in state parks and other DNR-managed projects in attempting to achieve their departmental objectives. Many of the departmental objectives relate to the preservation and maintenance of land or water areas for the use and enjoyment of the general public. While lauding these objectives, they are in fact a direct contrast to the objectives of the permanent school fund. The inclusion of permanent school fund lands in DNR restricted areas removes the land from presently earning any revenue as a result. DNR is attempting to achieve two distinct and incompatible objectives with the same set of resources. And this is 1981, and nothing has happened. And I really don't know if an exchange of the Bond Waters land will ever happen without some type of legislative action on their part. And now, you know, members, we have, I've got letters in here where the DNR commissioner is telling the Boys Ford Band of the Indians that wanted to purchase a little parcel of land that was in their boundary, in the boundary of the reservation. And I have a letter here from then Commissioner Miriam under Governor Pawlenty saying, no, we only exchange land. We never, that's the only way we do this. You find us a parcel of land. Then in the next letter he says, no, give us money. So there's always been confusion of what should be done here. And finally, I'll wrap it up, but I have this very, very disturbing thing that has happened recently, and that is a new taking of school trust land, and even in this case, tax forfeited land, mostly in Representative Eklund's district, but a little bit of it in Representative Metz's district. And we have 28,000 acres of tax forfeited, St. Louis County, tax forfeited mineral rights. And we know they've drilled there, and that's where you were talking about, $4 billion worth of known mineral royalties. They think it's way more than that. And so you can see in the purple is all the school trust land, another 92,000 acres, much of it in Lake County, but a heck of a lot of it, if you take where, and I think you probably have it, Matt. Mr. Vanderland, and if you take a look where the current leases are and where there's known mineral potential, a lot of it is school trust land. So, you know, the question is, do we stop the confusion of what these lands are for? If they're for preserving for use, multiple use, that doesn't coincide with raising money, then I think the legislature and the DNR must appropriate the money. In other states, Aaron's position is totally independent of the DNR, and when somebody doesn't want cattle ranching in, you know, Arizona or New Mexico, usually some of the agencies like the Trust for Public Lands and that go out and raise the money, and they bid against the cattle farmer and pay the school trust. That's not happening here. And I have to give you one little last thing. You know, in 1993, I diverted, along with Senator Janicich and the help of now Senator Thomasoni, who was a representative, we diverted the University of Minnesota's mineral royalties. They used to go to the endowed chairs, and we stopped it at that point, and we put it in an endowment for the NRI to do actually research on how to mine copper and nickel and our precious metals, how to mine it in an environmentally sound way. Put the other half in a scholarship account that the university was kind enough to name the Iron Range Scholarship. And it started in 1993. They went back because you're always a year behind in collecting royalties. And today, the total amount in just those, what is it, 24 years, whatever it is, $138,807,868 of mineral royalties. The university has no patron that gives that kind of money. And because of that school, the scholarship fund, they have given out, in interest alone, they have given out $31,441,548 in scholarships. Last year, $2,166,000 at the Twin Cities campuses, $688,000 up in Duluth, $115,000 in Morris, and $104,000 at Crookston. So the potential for doing good things with the wealth of the school trust land is, I don't know, it's phenomenal. I don't think there's a way to describe the wealth that we still have in Minnesota with our school trust lands, the wealth that other states don't have, and the potential for our kids. You know, when I first came here, I think the school trust was worth $247 million, and now it's over $1 billion. And a lot of it has to do, you know, thanks to this guy, but when you think of the potential out there and what could be done, it's, you know, it's amazing. And I'll just end with this. I only had figures until 2012, and my replacement, I asked him to get me figures, but he never does. He's like a rabbit. He's off jumping all wrong in that direction.
He can't jump real well right now.
I know. He's got plantar fasciitis. It goes away just as fast as it came. But in any event, you know, the potential out there to do good things is phenomenal. Just to give you an example, I only had figures to 2012, but the 8th biggest school district in the Twin Cities metro area get almost $7 million a year for their students. And the 8 school districts on the Iron Range that produced all that wealth get about $300,000 a year. So, you know, we've done our part. We've mined this ore. We've put 80, I think it's about 84%, but I'm not going to argue with you over 4% up here. And we've done our part, and we've got a history. You know, the DNR has been moved along and kicked in the butt for 30 years on this issue. And we're basically at the same point we started, except I am glad that Aaron is in the position he's in, and maybe the legislature should look at other states and give him a little more authority and have the DNR be an advisor to this permanent school fund and their lands and wealth instead of him being an advisor to the DNR. And that's nothing against the DNR because, you know, I kind of like Bob Myers and, you know, I really love Jess Richards. He's a good Iron Range guy. So it's nothing against them, but you have to give them the direction. So with that, Mr. Chair, if anybody wants, if your staff wants to copy 26 years of interesting letters to Congress and Senator Klobuchar and everybody else, I've got it all here for you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Rukavina. You do a great job of not only representing the kids, but you also represent Iron County really well, too. First on the list, Representative Eklund, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Vanderlyn. Thank you for your presentation. I'm a little concerned on maybe the tenor. You said the pulp and paper industry takes 70% of the forest land out of the production off of school trust. Is it the intention that you will keep dual certification because it is critical for our forest products industry, especially pulp and paper?
Commissioner Vanderlyn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, members, it is our intention to keep dual certification. That point came out of that report loud and clear. We must keep dual certification.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. And then the other thing is that if this potential land swap goes through from the Boundary Waters, I'm certainly not happy with $3 million a year. I think we need to hold Congress accountable for that if, in fact, it comes through, because I do not want to see you as making this your career to go back and ask for $3 million a year from the federal government.
Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eklund, I would like to see it wrapped up sooner rather than later myself.
John Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can attest I've got about 7 boxes and a whole filing cabinet left of other documents that former representative and now Commissioner Rukavina left me to fumble through, and there is a lot of value in learning from our history. And so, you know, from a young guy taking over and now being able to say thank you for my child who will benefit from this. We didn't get a per pupil question, and I know you probably know, or if not the exact number now, I know Mr. Vanderlyn, Director Vanderlyn knows. In our public schools statewide, what is the per pupil amount given in the formula statewide?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza, members, I believe the number this year is right at $30 a child.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That $30 in times of tight budgets like we were in a few years ago and growing as we move forward, you know, is a great thing. And so that comes mostly from mining revenue. And I think the direction that we've headed is the right one. I've taken over. I met with John Benson in my first term, who was our lead on the school trust, and didn't follow it. And fortunately, I've been on the committee for a few years, but
I think the DNR is bugging the committee.
Yeah. But it's an honor to follow the footsteps, because the work that you've laid out in your tenure here at the Capitol and work you're continuing to is important on this. We've got a lot of potential to grow this account and make it into something I think that can be a lot more than what it is and returning a lot more value to the students of the state. A continued partnership with both of you. And, yeah, I'm not too hopping like a rabbit right now, Commissioner. My foot's not so fun to walk on. Thank you for coming down and testifying and bring the information. We appreciate it.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vanderlyn, as you were talking about forestry and your plans for long-term management, and that's always good to be thinking long-term, you didn't talk about how our forests are changing with the change in the temperature. How are you factoring that into your long-term plans?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, and members, the potential for carbon sequestration markets and selling carbon credits on Minnesota's school trust lands is real. We have already started some additional analysis on that, or some initial analysis on that. Actually, when I was in D.C. with Paul Danisek from Friends of the Boundary Waters, he volunteered a college class that does some research for the Friends every year. They would look at that issue. And the way I'm looking at it, just in general, is when we reforest, can we do the reforestation in a longer-lived species as opposed to what's there now? And at the same time, set it up for carbon sequestration trading under that. So we are looking at that. We're looking at that as an economic opportunity for the trust.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr.
You're welcome.
Okay, so you are working on changing species. So I don't think folks quite understand that that's part of what's going on. But in terms of credits for carbon sequestration, that's a good idea, but what I have understood is that's for new forests, not for force we already have. There's no new in that. But if you are creating new forests or enhancing forests, that's where you get the sequestration. Is that my understanding correct on that?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius and members, I have a little different understanding than that. And your first point is we'd be changing the species, and in fact what we would be doing is actually looking at the soil types and the soil characteristics of a specific area and making sure that, one, we're growing the right trees on that land. That's what wants to grow on a certain spot. When you do that, in my understanding to your second point, is when you're actually changing your management practices on the land, that's when you can actually apply and get certified for carbon sequestration trading. Even if you have an existing forest there, our birch forest, or birch and aspen forests on the North Shore, there's no market for them. They're falling apart. What used to be there was a pine forest. So what you would, in theory, do in certain areas, and they're actually working on this in a program up on the North Shore with some school trust lands, where they're actually converting it back to a long-lived pine species. And then that would allow you, my understanding is once you change that management, you could open it up for carbon trading.
Quick follow-up.
Okay, that makes sense. However, what we, when we go out in the forests, what we're seeing and watching them, you know, cut them down, what's coming in is maple. So we're not planting, we're just letting maple grow. And is that happening on school trust lands?
Director Van Hollen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius and members, I believe that's the goal of this whole reforestation effort, or reinvesting in reforestation on school trust lands, is getting the right species there that's not a pioneer species like maple that doesn't have, you know, a lot of economic benefit, and actually reinvesting in a long-lived pine species or something along that, that's actually better, grows better in a warmer climate. It actually is the soil that wants to grow pine, so we'd actually stop the spread, so to speak, of the maple and actually be reinvesting in a pine species, if you will.
Okay. Representative Hansen?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Rukavina, I'd heard a rumor that there actually was like a caucus of former legislators at the Association of Minnesota Counties now, that there's so many of you there that you can meet and have your own group meetings. But my actual question was, you know, there are other assets besides the surface rights and below surface rights. There's wind rights. There are wetland credits. And I don't think I heard you mention those. And I'm wondering if those are reserved to the trust because it's silent, or if there's something that has to be done to protect those assets that may be retained by the people of Minnesota.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen and members, we are looking at those as economic drivers as well, looking at the potential for that. Just as a specific example, in Mountain Iron, on a Section 16 in Mountain Iron, we actually did and do have a lease for wind rights at Mountain Iron on that parcel. The problem with the wind rights is, you know, the best wind in the state is actually in the southwestern part of the state, and we've sold all of our land down there, or the majority of our land. So then you look at the high-value pieces, and they're on, you know, lakeshores and things like that. But that's definitely one of the things we're looking at, is wind potential. Those are some of the new revenue opportunities that I didn't talk about. But wetland banking and wetland credits are another one. And as I said, you know, my staff has been a godsend. You know, we've identified a program that Bowser runs for county road projects, where they actually have a need and a deficit for wetland banking credits, and whether we're trying to determine whether or not there's some opportunities where we can partner with them to actually put those lands that, you know, are wet in nature into wetland banking and sell those as credits. There's a three-step process on how you actually do that, and we're working through that right now. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could quickly.
You could.
There's one asset that wasn't mentioned, you just briefly mentioned it, and that is the amount of lakeshore property that mm-hmm. the
DNR had traded for. And in 1998, I believe it was, we put an amendment on the tax bill and the ways in the tax bill, I think it was. And we just said that there's not going to be an auction. There's going to be a land-for-land exchange, value-for-value on these lease legislature lots that were left. On 498, I think, or 68 lakeshore lots, the DNR got a bunch of lakeshore. They got 21 or 22 miles of lakeshore on Lake Vermilion and own all the way around a lake right next to Vermilion called Bass Lake. And I said, I'm going to come back 10 years from now and ask you what, how much money you raised off of all that lakeshore you got. And in 2008, we had the crash. We had this budget bill that then Speaker Anderson Keller put me on, and I brought it up, and they hadn't raised a penny, and they still haven't. And, you know, all that lakeshore, I hate to see it not remain pristine in lakeshore, but then, you know, maybe the Lassard Sams or somebody should buy it because the school kids aren't getting any revenue off of it, and it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Thank you, members. I'm sure that this discussion is going to continue. I'm looking forward to doing that. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.